Hey folks, welcome back to another episode of What Goes Wrong with Justin's Tech as he's trying to live stream, which has like been the reoccurring theme of the past like three. Like I had weird tech stuff with Dr. Switza last week in Cleveland, the tech failed. Yesterday with Angela, the power went out. The forces of Citra Achra are really, you know, but they say that they attack you more if you're righteous, but that's totally not the case in my case. Zevi, welcome back, brother.
Good to be with you, Justin. They're catching on to you, the evil forces. They're hot on your trail.
Something, man. Something. All right, folks. So welcome back to our sixth installment studying the Yanuka. We're in the thick of it in the battle of the Torah. Zevi, any reflections from last time? It was some pretty beautiful, pretty lovely stuff last time. I think we're not going to repeat that this time. It's going to get kind of ugly, but any reflections from last time?
Yeah, we're definitely about to change tone and gears here. Yeah. Last time was really splendid. It felt to me like a very climactic part of the text and this narrative that we've been painting out here. It seemed like a point where the boundaries between the terrestrial and the extraterrestrial, the mundane and the metaphysical, was rent asunder, and we saw that crack open in the text. It was interesting building up towards that, and now I think we're going to see a bit of a come down from it, and we're here for the journey wherever the Yanuka takes us.
That's right. Yeah, I get the same feeling, right? There's sort of like there's that moment where like we go above the clouds and it's all light and beauty, and now we're going to plunge right back into the depths. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like, I think the narrative arc of the Zohar kind of does that to you, right? It wants you to ascend to the great heights to get a taste of all that the divine has to offer and all of its beauty. But also, you know, the real task is not that. The real task is to get down into the depths of the really bad stuff and redeem it. And so on the one hand, last week is sort of a chazak. It gives us a little bit of strength through beauty so that we can dive down, I think, into these more gross sections. And we can talk about them more. But yeah, I think that's the Zohar's kind of leading us on. But yeah, also just thanks for everyone in the chat who's joining us this morning for some Zohar study and the folks who join us later. I'm just really... I don't know how you feel, Zevi, but I just am so stoked that, you know, dozens of people come and hang out every week and learn some Zohar with us. It's just like makes my Thursdays better.
Yeah. My one and only regret in this context is that we, because of, you know, the restrictions of geography and time and space and those stubborn illusions, as Einstein put them, that we can't be doing this in a room together with a live audience and people get to, you know, be present and feel their presence and ask questions. That's right. Maybe one day we'll have the merit to do that.
Bezra Hashem. Let's do it. Let's open. So I guess I'll start.
Go for it.
All right. So we opened the Yanuka is, this is after dinner, right? This is after dinner. They've not said the blessing though, right? They finish eating, but have they benched yet?
Not that we've seen. They've just been lingering at the table.
Right. So this is pre-benching, some light after dinner talk here. So he opened, saying, Moav said to the elders of Midian, now this assembly will lick up everything around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. I love that image. Moav said to the elders of Midian, right? So Moav said to the elders of Midian, it is not written, the elders of Moav said to the elders of Midian, but rather Moav said. So the Zohar is indicating that because it says Moav said, it must not be elders, because otherwise it would have been the elders of Midian said to the elders of Moav, but they're indicating here that it was not the elder, it was the young people, right? The young took advice from the elders, and the elders were drawn to them and gave them advice. What advice do they give? Evil advice they took for themselves. So this is interesting. I want to stop here because I think that there's something interesting in about the dialectic here. One, there's a real question of responsibility, right? That when young people come to elders asking for advice, that's a heavy thing. And the advice that the elders allegedly give here is evil advice. And just sort of the one of the lessons to be learned here is that when you know you talk to young people, you know, what advice you give is very, very prescient. And I like this idea because I think about this as a parent, that being a parent is one of the greatest things about being a parent in my experience is the opportunity to be the better person, because you know that there are younger people watching you and modeling your behavior. So it's an opportunity to be the better person. And so when someone asks you advice, one of the lessons to be learned here is don't give advice that you think is best. Give the advice that is best. But notice here, even when you give good advice, even if you do, which we can maybe say here that the elders of the media didn't, notice evil advice they took for themselves. I wonder, right? Like, I'd love to look at the Aramaic, but we don't actually get to hear the advice the Moabites gave them. The elders of Moab could have given them good advice, right? But if the Midianites are out to do evil, they'll take evil advice, no matter what advice is given. Evil advice they took for themselves. So what an interesting, like, you know, like, it's interesting that we can assume that the Midianites gave them bad advice, evil advice, right? But the Moabites, right, they took for themselves. So it's interesting that there's a responsibility in terms of giving advice, but there's also a responsibility in terms of taking advice.
Right. Which we see here in the text, right? Mm-hmm. That what advice did they give them is the question. And the answer is evil advice they took for themselves.
Right.
And there's also this obfuscation here of it's actually Moab who said to the elders of Midian. And then that kind of gets reversed, that I think there's a bit of an intentional play here where we're switching out elders for the youth. Mm-hmm. But then the reception is switched for the giver as well.
Right. Yeah. And the Zohar loves to do that. Switch the elders for the younger, right? Like it'll invert father-in-law, son-in-law relationship, things like that. And for that, we know from the Talmud, it'll often inverse those.
There's also an interesting parallel that came up for me here to the, to a well-known medrash on the book of Esther, on the Megillah that we read on Purim, which is in the second chapter, the King Ahasuerus asks for advice. And the advice, it says, is given to him from the youth. The youth in the palace say to him, and the Medrash points out that the reason why it was the youth giving advice is because all of the advisors in chapter one who had given the advice that Vashti, the queen, be killed, were killed when Ahasuerus sobered up. So the only people left to give advice were the youth. And the advice which they give is the advice of youth, which is to hold this, you know, extravagant beauty pageant and to round up all of the virgins in the country. And I think that there might be an intentional parallelism or like hyperlink between here and Esther. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see that the advice that they give is also the advice of youth in some way, or the advice that was taken is the advice of youth, right? It's also related to bringing around beautiful women. That's what the youngsters, that's their idea of good advice.
Right. That's a great parallel. Great timing, right? Like, we're now welcome to Adar, everyone. We're in the month where things should be getting better. Hopefully we'll get to some more joyful sections in this one.
God willing.
Yeah. So they said to Moab, we've raised an evil growth in our midst. That's such a terrifying language. An evil growth in our midst. And who is that? Moses, their master. Because of a certain priest, Yishai, the Midianite that took Moses in, who was amongst us, who trained him, who raised him in his house and gave him his daughter in marriage. Furthermore, he gave him money and sent him to Egypt to destroy the whole country. And he and all his household will draw after him. If we uproot the master of theirs from his world, his whole people will immediately be uprooted from the world. The whole wicked plan about the affair of the Baal at Peor came from Midian. So this is a interesting kind of temporality, because the incident of Baal Peor takes place at the very end of the 40-year exile, right? The 40-year journey in the wilderness. This is like the very last thing that happens before they kind of get ready to cross over. But this is sort of happening. The plotting here is happening before Moses even gets to Egypt. So this is like a plot 40 years in the making, allegedly. Like, they're already like plotting 40 years out. You get that sense, Zevi?
Oh, I didn't realize whether they were plotting it in advance or in retrospect.
Right. Like, it's like, and like he was sent him to Egypt to destroy the whole country and all of his house were drawn. Yeah, it just, it seems like, yeah, it's sort of a weird, when is this happening exactly? Because it has to obviously be happening before the incident of Baal Peor.
I mean, this whole framework is very interesting. It's a whole reframing of the narrative, which we're not used to, right? This whole idea that Yisro, Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, sent Moses with money as some sort of like mole into destroy Egypt.
Right.
I think it makes for a much better story, actually. Like, this is...
When also sort more... of, I mean, to modern ears, it very much sounds like sort of anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, right? Like, this really rings as like, you know, that the Jews are the fifth column. You know, they're here to, they're sent in to
undermine the...
Yeah. So it has a sort of, and one wonders, right? I mean, again, this is a 13th century text. One wonders, you know, the blood libel and those kinds of things are already beginning to emerge. One wonders if, again, I think we said this before we started, that it's impossible for me not to read this sections about the non-Jewish enemies of Israel without reading into it the Spanish context of these texts.
Sure.
Where we're living in sort of a nigh to Reconquista period in Spanish history. These are not quite the days of Alfonso the Wise.
Right.
So, but yeah, it's an interesting reframing.
It's also a very, I mean, it's a reframing that the authors of the Zohar are doing from the perspective of the enemy, right? So they're telling you what the enemy is thinking,
right.
And and in that there's a very subtle. I mean, a lot of war is like soft war, and how do we frame narratives, and how do we and this framing changes Moses from a freedom fighter who goes to liberate a people in slavery, a marginalized nation, to this powerful spy with resources who's going to undermine an empire. He goes from being essentially a freedom fighter to a terrorist, and just right. with a few very short words. And that also struck me how it's the author of the Zohar saying how the story would have been told by the enemy of Israel. It's like an interesting it's an interesting double thing there.
That's great. And also, it is interesting. I mean, does the Torah never says it? Jesse ever gave him money?
Yes,
or even sent him. Yeah, Jethro. Like it never says like.
Oh yeah, money, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. Not as far as I'm aware. No, yeah. It's certainly like really raises him as this, as like this intentional like like a target missile sent by Jethro. Right, right. And again, by the way, we had this earlier where we said that Moses was raised in Midian.
Right.
Which we said at the time that he wasn't. He was raised in Egypt, and he leaves as an adult, mature adult already. But here again, in this framing, it's clearly this fictional reframing on behalf of the enemy, where he's this product of Midian, like that's kind of trained under the tutelage of Jethro. Which is
right.
The other thing which caught my interest here was, and this is very, very typical of the Kabbalists, that for the Kabbalists, the enemies of Israel are very astute Kabbalists or magicians or metaphysicians themselves. Like they're evil, but they know what's up, right? There's this this theory of the parallel where it's like that God creates everything like side to side. So like the Balaam is a parallel to Moses, and then sort of the energies of good are faced off against the energies of evil, or vice versa. And over here, this point which they say that if we can uproot the master of theirs from the world, his whole people will be immediately uprooted from the world. It's like something which the Kabbalists would be saying about Moses in reverse, right?
Right.
They'd be saying that if Moses has power, then the people have power, that Moses is the metaphysical parallel. So and we're gonna see this theme continue throughout, that the enemy of Israel is not an idiot, is not unaware of the metaphysical workings of reality. They're very aware, but they're using it for their own nefarious purposes, and that we'll see again and again here.
Right. And this is clearly, we're in Sitra Achra territory. Like this is, I think, you know, these sections, I think, are they're kind of redundant on other sections from previous. We've kind of already rehashed this, but the Zohar never stops at an opportunity to sort of go after, Amalek or Moab or Ammon. But also, these are the forces of Sitra Achra. So it's really important that when we're studying these sections, we're not talking about historical Moabites. Like, we're talking about, you might use the language of archetypes, but or metaphysical realities. Yeah. More so than, more so than, it's funny because I've been reading about Moabites a lot recently. And so it's funny, like, to read these sections and, you know, to actually listen to it. I've been reading about Moabites and Midianites and all the ites.
Certainly, whoever authored this text, at whatever time frame you want to place them, never saw a Midianite in their life and never had the opportunity. And as this text will be continuing to be read throughout the centuries, particularly in the Hasidic movement, these are all going to be internalized, psychologized, however you want to turn it, and this is something that applies for everyone. Whoever is reading the text, Jew or non-Jew, is identifying the inner Moabite, the inner Midianite, and that refers to different character defects or different traits that one needs to root out from within themselves. Did you have something about the affair of Par that you were going to explain for us in the audience?
I guess we'll get more to it in a minute, but basically it's just a moment where, you know, the Moabites basically lure some Israelites, a chunk of them, into idolatry, but idolatry right on the eve of crossing into the Promised Land, which is especially egregious, right? Because there's something forgivable about the whole business of the ark, of the golden calf, right? There's something forgivable about that. Like, they just come out of bondage. They were the way the Maimonides are kind of habituated to, you know, these kinds of forms of worship, and so it's forgivable. But there's something about the fact that after ever how many years of seeing firsthand, and then seeing literally with their eyes that they're about to cross over, that they would again apostatize. So the incident of Baal Peor is, I think, in the Torah and also in the Zohar, somehow especially egregious.
Yeah,
it's especially horrifying that kind of apostasy could have happened. And in a way that I think that the Zohar sort of imagines the golden calf to be a necessary evil, the way we talked about earlier. Mm. But this was a kind of evil that was egregious, I think.
It's very interesting. And it's a theme that you see throughout the, you know, Jewish mystical literature and perhaps even beyond, where the forces of evil or darkness or however it's being phrased will give their final hurrah right before the break of dawn. Right. If anyone's stayed up, particularly near a coastline right before dawn breaks, the coldest part of night, and the darkest ostensibly is right before sunbreak. And there's a sense, and this is brought down in Kabbalistic and Hasidic texts, that there's like the analogy given of two people wrestling one another, and the force of evil, the other wrestler here, is going to give their final umph of energy before they're about to be defeated. And that's a particularly treacherous moment, because it's that moment of transition. It's a liminal stage of leaving from exile to redemption, and that's where the Sitra Achra is going to try, the forces of evil are going to try and rear their ugly heads, as it is.
Right, and you see that sort of an apocalyptic idea, just with even in, you know, think Christianity, right, with the Antichrist and Judaism as well. Yeah, it's or even Islam, right, with like the Iblis and the sort of their version of the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the idea that you grip tightest when you're about to let go.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the hardest moment to contend with evil.
Yeah, and it's going to be the most regrettable in retrospect because of how close they were to tasting redemption.
Right.
And for the Kabbalists, that means tasting inner redemption and whatnot.
Yep. Yeah, it's a the incident about Baal Peor is like, yeah, it's, I think, one of the great horrors of the Torah. So come and see, right? Come and see that everything stemmed from Midian. And all their counsel was aimed at Moses. This is one of the things I find also just kind of like cringy about the Zohar, is it never wants to put any responsibility on the Israelites. it's always explaining away why they make their mistake. That's what I think one of the cringy things about the Zohar. It's always someone else's fault. It's Midian's fault, this whole business of Baal Peor.
Right. But there's a pairing here as well, which is happening, right? Everything stems from Midian and all the counsel of Moses. Moses and Midian, we're going to be pairing those two up here.
Right. Yep. So on their advice, Balaam was commissioned. Folks may know Balaam was the prophet who was charged to curse Israel but ended up blessing them, who actually we know of from non-biblical sources. Balaam is known. There was a plaster wall that was discovered that had some of Balaam's prophecy on it. So he was a well-known figure outside of the Bible. So he's uniquely attested outside of the Torah.
Not bad.
Yeah,
they got their money's worth.
Yeah. He was a man about town. Dear Allah, I think is where the plaster was found. Hmm. On their advice, Balaam was commissioned. As soon as they saw Balaam, they could not prevail. They adopted another evil plan. Right. It's interesting. It said they said as soon as they saw Balaam,
as soon as they saw that Balaam could not prevail,
right, they adopted another plan. And so they prostituted their wives and daughters even more than Moab did. For of the Midianite women, it is written, look, these are those who, by Balaam's word, led the children of Israel to betray Yokevavke in the affair of the Baal of Peor. Everything stemmed from Midian. So, again, they're kind of like, they're
just in
like,
case you weren't sure about it.
Right. Yeah, just to repeat it. Yeah. But essentially, again, they kind of had tabs on Balaam, right?
Mm.
That they kind of like are watching from a distance, which is a sense you don't get. You don't really get that from the sense from the Torah, right? But Balaam is sort of an independent agent in the Torah, but you don't get the sense that he's like, he's just basically an agent sent by them. Also, folks may know this, that the mouth of the donkey of Balaam is one of the 10 things created at the eve of the first Shabbat. I love all the weird, the 10 things get created. The tongs are my favorite. The primordial tongs, but the voice of Balaam's donkey was also created then.
Yes.
Which also, you get the sense that like that God has kind of planned it all out. Like
right.
But like
right.
It's already a done deal.
Yeah.
I'll finish this paragraph and then we'll jump over. So they conspired with their chieftain that he should prostitute his daughter. Right.
Wait, what did you think of this transition from this? First, we'll try magic, then we'll try sex. What did you think of that?
They should have tried sex first.
skip right ahead.
Yeah, I've been around some dudes. I happen to be one. I'm not that seduced by prophets, but I've heard lots of things about these Moabite ladies. Yeah, you get the sense that again, like that it's sort of writing this in Zohar language that, you know, the text is a very embodied text, right? Mm. Like Balaam, at some level, is kind of working kind of a prophetic kind of thing, but the Zohar is a very embodied text. It's a very sex-powerful text, and therefore sex, right? Like, and there's something about illicit sex for the Zohar, too, that's especially, whether it's masturbation or fornication or whatever, there's something about illicit sex that the Zohar finds especially powerful, because sex is so powerful for the Zohar, obviously. Illicit sex somehow would be even more powerful.
Prophecy.
I mean, Netzach and Hod. Who cares about Netzach and Hod, right? We never like.
Right.
And they're associated typically with prophecy, but it's sex that has guns, I think, for the Zohar.
That's a great formulation, by the way. I'm going to use that in the future if you don't mind. That it's not sex negative or sex positive. It's sex powerful.
Yeah.
That's a good way of putting it.
Because it's, again, Zohar is all about how you use this stuff, right?
Right.
And for the forces of Moab and Midian, it's going to be negative, but again, it's all about how sex gets deployed. And I think that's why sex is more powerful than prophecy for the Zohar, just because of how powerful sex is for the Zohar.
Hmm.
Yeah. So they conspired with their chieftain that he should prostitute his own daughter, right? This is how, again, this is a sort of the horror of illicit sexual relationships. And it gets a sense of like, in the way that the Hieros Gamos is very consensual in the body of the Sefirot, there's something about like, it's so the way that Israel and the Sefirot relationship is so much, it's related to like, it's so much about flirting and seducing enticing and arousing. Mm. Right, there's something very flirtatious around how the Zohar operates in terms of like licit sex, which is still highly erotic. Notice how this is not erotic at all. It's just force. Like he's forcing his daughter into this sort of sexual snare with Moses, and that's again I think the difference between the eroticism of the Hieros Gamos in the Sefirot versus the way that it's composed in Sitra Achra, where it's just compulsion. There's something very horrifying about the way that the chieftain is relating to his own daughter here, that that Hashem and, you know, the way that Tiferet and Yesod relate is a very like erotic relationship, but it's never force. Here, the relationship is pure force.
Hmm. It's very tactical and utilitarian and pragmatic. And
right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. It's a very, like tactical is a, you know, it's tactical deployment of eroticism.
Yeah.
Whereas
yeah.
The eroticism of the Zohar is very, it's all about jouissance, right? It's all about this sort of overpowering thing. Mm. So again, we have two different conceptions of how sex occurs. With many kinds of charms, they adorned her so that their leader would be caught. But the Blessed Holy One turns sages back. Again, you get the sense of like she's just being bedecked. Mm. She has no consent in this process. She's just being adorned. You get the sense of like they're hanging jewels and magical amulets upon her in this really horrifying way.
It's interesting. I saw a parallel here back to earlier, if you don't mind me just jumping in here a second.
Please.
That the Shekhinah, as she descends through the various stages, she is adorned with all, and I think we see here, and this we're going to see a lot of the direct parallel between the holy and the profane, or the holy and the evil, where they're both adorned, right? But one of them is an act of love and arousal and desire. And here it's again, as you're saying, it almost seems like it's shoved on her.
Yeah.
So it's the exact same thing happening, just flipped.
That's a great point. Yeah, I totally agree. That's something. And also like the kind of charms that she's getting, you get the sense that they're, you know, again, like there's double non-consent here, right? That if they are magical charms, she's being forced to wear them, and the love, the eroticism that would be aroused would not be because of Moses consenting to it. He'd be tricked into this relationship.
Right.
So it's doubly compulsive in a really dreadful way.
Yeah.
So they foresaw that the leader would be caught in their net, but they didn't understand. So God is going to laugh last, of course. So we'll laugh best. But again, also I like the fact here, right, that there will be a leader trapped, but it won't be Moses.
Yeah.
Sitra Achra still gets its peace, right? That God, clearly God's planned all this. God knows what's about to happen. But rather than simply the plan falling flat the way it did with Balaam, right, Sitra Achra still gets something in a way.
Hmm.
And the constant motif, or the author motif of the Zohar, of the giving the devil its due, I think gets played out here.
Interesting. Interesting that you're seeing that here. Interesting.
So they saw, yet they did not see, right? So we get two conceptions of seeing. They saw the leader of the people falling with her, along with many thousands of others, and they thought, ah, that was Moses. So they prostituted her, right? Instructing her about Moses, saying, couple only with him. So she said to them, how will I know who Moses is? And they replied, the one whom before you see everyone rising, couple with him and no one else. So when Zimri, son of Salu, appeared, this is one of the Simeonites, 24,000 members of the tribe of Simeon rose before him, since he was their chieftain. So she thought he was Moses, and she coupled with him. When all others saw this, they did what they did, and what happened. I love how the Zohar is chas v'shalom.
Right.
Like it doesn't.
Right.
It's so horrible. they did what they did, and what happened.
There's something, as it was, and what happened.
Yep. There's something so. This is something so. Oh, and also, right. It's worth mentioning. I think they mentioned this, right, that the woman that couples with him, his name is Cosby. And the name Cosby is from the root, which means to lie. Right. The rabbis loved to pun on Kochba and Kozeba, right? Son of a star versus son of a liar is a false pretender. But Cosby, right. That again, we're dealing with, like you said, archetypes are these more metaphysical things that there's something purely deceptive about her seduction.
Right.
And that again is sort of very opposite of the way Shekhinah and the way Shekhinah is aroused is through openness, is through light, is through clarity. Whereas Cosby is a lie.
No relation to Bill Cosby, we should say.
Well, I think maybe a relation actually. A kind of really
no familial.
Right. Yeah, if we're writing a modern Zohar, Cosby and Cosby might. Don't read Cosby.
I'll take Rearish. Don't read X, rather Y.
Yeah.
There's a couple interesting things going on here. Mm-hmm. It might be worth it just to take it back down from the top a little. This notion of they see, but they did not see, Chazi v'lei Chazi, that there's this notion that the evil can see, but it's like through a glass darkly. So they saw something. They saw that it was the leader, and they thought it was Moses. And then she sees a leader, and she thinks there's this double level of obfuscation and of darkness that the evil is trying to peer through. And they did see. They had a vision. And I think this very clearly parallels there's a lot of parallels being drawn here to many midrashim around the corpus. One is to the magicians of Egypt seeing that a leader would rise from Israel to redeem them, and which spurs on Pharaoh's attempt to drown all the male children in the Nile. This sense of trying to thwart the people and trying to thwart Moses, but not really seeing and getting confused along the way. And those midrashim around Moses, I think, are being evoked here as well.
In the Zohar, it's really about sight, right? That you know, come and see, tachazeh. Mm. Like the fact that they you know, and they said, right, the opening of this section is come and see, and that idea that, you know, we see and they don't,
right?
That's like, again, the way that the way that sight is being conceived, and who sees and who doesn't, some very Gnostic-y kind of
right
sort of some Gnostic-y kind of connotations.
Also, this whole language of how will I know, that she's trying to figure out who she's needs to be. Firstly, I mean, seems to be a direct parallel between Moses being sent by Jethro on his mission to Egypt and Cosby being sent on her mission. There's this parallel again, but this whole how will I know, this was bugging me when I was reading the text the first time, because I knew that there was some really strong parallel here to somewhere else in the Jewish corpus, in this question of how will I know, and the response of, oh well, you see someone for who the people are standing, and that is, and I had a couple near hits, but I didn't, it's still bugging me, and it's not being resolved for me. Is there any hits to other narratives that are coming up for you with this question and answer of hers
about standing,
of how will I know who to seduce? And I was thinking of the story of Yehuda and Tamar, the story of Esther and Ahasuerus, like a couple different sexual relations that are unclear about who the target is and how to be identified were coming up for me. But there's a Yehudas in the Hanukkah story, but none of them really hit the spot for me.
No, I can't think of any particular things. No, nothing jumps out to me. I mean, the imagery of standing also has sort of Yesod energy.
Right.
Right. That strikes me as like Yesod language, right. the standing up, the being erect.
Right. The closest no. I got was Ahasuerus, who stands up his scepter to Esther when she comes in. And there's also that language of how will I know if it was for this purpose that you were put into this question of how will I know around sexuality. There's sort of this immense power in this. I mean, we can read Cosby also here as a vulnerable character. Right.
Sure. Oh yeah. I definitely read her that way.
She's being coerced into this coercive activity, and she's being weaponized. Her sexuality is being weaponized here. Is what's happening. And she's, and there's this sense of, she's afraid. She doesn't know, she's being sent off, and who knows how old she is at the time. She could be for the standard of the day, she could have been a very young woman, if that, and the sense of her asking how I know, it's almost like this very scared woman, child, not knowing where she's being sent to, which man she's being sent to. There's fear here, there's some pathos here that I'm reading too.
Yeah. And the parallel with the eunuch, right? That this is a young boy telling a story about a young woman.
Right.
A boy and a girl. Also, there's the sad irony of how Cosby will die. Right.
Yeah.
There's something about the erection of Zimri standing up, and that they both will be pierced through with a spear.
There's another phallic object,
another phallic object, and very pierced through the body in this I think that the Zohar really, I think, is there's something about this sort of erection stuff that's going on,
right?
that they're really putting on. But yeah, and you get the sense of, like, you know, again, like you said with Cosby, you don't want to blame her,
right?
But she's still, like, again, it's like a child soldier, you know, but still right. part of the chakra.
Right.
And of course her ending is a dreadful one.
Right. It's there is also a perhaps another reading which is just occurring to me now of there's a discussion in the Talmud which got picked up by the Kabbalists, of course, of the sexual heroism or sexual valor performed by different women in Jewish history. And there's a contrast made between Sarah, the wife of Abraham, and Yehudit in the Hanukkah story, who murders the Seleucid general,
right?
Yael as well, right? There's a sense where and the Talmud has this whole discussion of whose sexuality was more meritorious, and there's a sense again here of this theme which is going to be replete throughout the Zohar of Zeh lo matzeh bar Elokim, that the evil and the good are directly right. juxtaposed. So the sense of Cosby heading into the Jewish camp to try to take down the leader, and Yael and Yehudit heading in to take down the enemy, and in those stories, what we see from memory, we see a much more assertive and brave woman figure, where Yehudit goes into the camp knowing exactly who she's going for, and she goes prepared with a plan. Maybe there's a feminist reading to do here of the empowerment of the feminine on the sacred versus the exploitation on the evil side, perhaps.
Yeah, and yeah, with the tent post and Pinchas with the spear. I mean, it's
right, right.
That there's many ways to dispatch people in the ancient world, but
well, the fifth rib is a classic for the biblical.
Yeah, the tent stake is just like that image. Oof. Yeah. You want to pick up?
Sure.
After what happened?
So what happened, what was, as they say here. Mm-hmm. Everything stemming from Midian in various ways, and therefore Midian was punished. The Holy Blessed One said to Moses, "Wreak the vengeance of the children of Israel upon the Midianites." Numbers 31:2. "For you it is fitting, for you it is appropriate." For you, here referring to Moses, as we will see shortly. "As for Moab, I will defer them until two pearls issue from them. It is David, son of Jesse, David ben Yishai, who will wreak vengeance upon Moab, washing out the pot full of filth, as it is written, Moab is my wash basin, Psalms 60:10. Surely, until those two pearls issue, Moab was not punished. As soon as they did, David came and washed the filth out of the pot. All of them were punished. Moab in the days of Moses, and Midian in the days of Moses, and Moab in the days of David." So this is a theme that we saw earlier of that God will not destroy the nation until the time that they produce the positive spark that is hidden in their very thick and coarse husks. It's interesting. We've been jumping around with different metaphors to describe the same thing. We had a fig tree earlier. We had wheat, I think, the second time. Maybe, and this, if this is right, that is the third time. We now have pearls inside of a filthy wash basin. Very kind of classic vitriolic imagery for people that the authors certainly don't like, the sense of the pearl and the clam. What do you see here, Justin?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's sort of repeating what you said, and but at the same time, I mean, even though this language is very xenophobic and worrying in that way, there's not pure evil here, right? Like, the Zohar doesn't really deal in pure evil. The idea is that that even these nations that the Zohar views as evil still produce not just good, but decisively good,
right?
Right? Like, you know, with it's David, right? David's like right. The entire world will be redeemed through that line, and I think that that's an important. It's not just pearls in the wash bin; it's the very root of redemption comes from Moab.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's a point to be made about that, And again, this is to the point of Sitra Achra, right? That there's something about, and this, you know, in later Kabbalah gets developed by Chaim Vital and other people, that the soul of the Messiah is sunk deepest into the world of Sitra Achra. And it's only because of the sunkness of Mashiach's soul that it's able to emerge.
Yeah.
And I think that imagery of, the wash bin full of filth. Yeah, like Moab and Midian are bad, but it's only from them that redemption comes. Midian from Moses, from Moab comes Mashiach.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really, really fascinating theme, and there's been a lot explored there. It's interesting that we haven't made that point explicit here. I mean, it's very much between the lines throughout, and there's many, many different reasons and explanations given why that's the case. Why all of the lineage of the Jewish Messiah comes through the most evil and also the most sexually promiscuous narratives in the Bible, right? It's, as we said, it's the stories of Lot and his daughters. It's the story of Yehuda and Tamar, which gives birth to Peretz, which is going to be also a progenitor of the Messiah. It's that all of them, I mean, there's this classic explanations given that the Sitra Achra has its guard up so high against the soul of the Messiah, the only way it can slip into our terrestrial realm is through the most illicit places where the Sitra Achra won't care to check and look. All kinds of interesting ideas, but I think there's some more profound psychological readings perhaps than just the metaphysical, and those may be somewhat obvious for someone who gives it some attention. Tachazi, come and see the wicked of Midian. We're about to do some show and tell. For despite all this, they did not subside from all their evil. Generations later, when they saw, again seeing, that Joshua had died along with all those elders who were worthy to have miracles performed by them, they said, "Now the time is ripe for us." What did they do? What did the Midianites do? They approached Amalek saying, "You should remember what the Israelites and Moses, their master, and Joshua, his disciples, did to you, annihilating you from the world." Which is such a great expression, because for anyone that knows the place that Amalek has in Jewish thought and law, the obligation is for the Jew to remember Amalek. And here the Midianite is telling the Amalek, "You should remember what the Israelites did to you." It's the exact reversal to what what Amalek did to you when you were in the desert, Asher Karcha Baderech, when they attacked you on the way. So this is a great reversal. Clearly being ridden by a Jew, that's very clear. Mm-hmm. And annihilating you from the world, which is also a funny expression, because if they were annihilating you from the world, then there would be no one to talk to, but attempting to annihilate you from the world, let's say. Now it is the time. Now is the time, for they have no one to protect them, and we are with you. So this theme again, that they understand full well that when Joshua, Moses, and the elders are gone, that their protection is gone, the Israelites' protection is gone. This is again the enemy of Israel knowing full well the metaphysics of Israel at play. And we are with you, we're here to support you, which is the fear of Pharaoh, you know, that people would gang up, and we're here. Immediately, Midian and Amalek and the Easterners came up and raided them. Because of Midian, as a result, the book of Judges tells us, the children of Israel made themselves the dugouts that are in the mountains, namely that they had to run away from the face of their assailants. There was no one in the world who perpetrated evil as utterly as Midian. And if anyone reads this, if anyone that knows a bit of, is anyone who's literate in Judaism, there's a question which immediately pops up to them, and the text asks that question for us. If you say Amalek, if you ask any Jew on the street today, who's the most evil nation on the face of the earth, they'll tell you Amalek. And here we're saying no, Midian. And so therefore the Zohar, the Yunuka asks, and if you say Amalek, well, Amalek because of jealousy for the covenant, for they accosted the supernal covenant, the Sphira Yesod, so the Holy One vents eternal jealousy that will never be forgotten. So there's a specific animosity and lack of forgetfulness applied to Amalek, but who is actually the greater perpetrator of evil, according to the Yunuka, according to the Zohar, which is a very non-standard Jewish opinion, we should say, it is Midian rather than Amalek.
Right. For those who see and those who see not enough, right? Most of the Jews on the street would say Amalek, but the real, it's Midian, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like those who see but don't see enough.
Right, right.
It's the brains behind the thing.
That's pulling the strings, yeah.
Right. That's why Midian is But Amalek earned a specific, you know, specific punishment because of, right. And the Matt tells us, right, that that they earned this because allegedly they castrated Israelites and threw their penises into the air, which was a direct affront to Yesod, right? It's mocking Yesod.
Right. Obviously, because the place of the sign of the covenant is there, and it's saying, it's basically telling God, look, your covenant is meaningless, and here it is, and therefore the covenant will not be forgotten, and the chevraya, the companions respond to the Inuka. They said, certainly so, there is no doubt in the world. No doubt, no diggity, no doubt. Which is well put here, because part of the function of Amalek in Jewish thought is the cause of doubt, right? So them saying no doubt seems to be on point. Mm-hmm.
Which is interesting, because again, like if you ask a Jew on the street about the evil nation, they'll say Amalek, and it's funny, yeah. They say there's no doubt. Of course there's doubt.
Right.
Like the Zohar is, this is an innovation of Torah.
Right. Yeah. It's there is something. Yeah. There's a few ways we could read this. No doubt. It's either them trying to not be fronted by the Yonoka and be like, yeah, of course we knew this. Right. Or there's probably a few different ways to read that. No doubt. Cause it certainly is doubtful, as you're saying.
Right. And again, the phrase of annihilating them from the world, the sense is that obviously they're not annihilated from the world, but also there's a sense that Amalek still exists. There's still like the obligation to destroy Amalek is a forever obligation.
Right. Although it does become spiritualized at a point in history.
Yeah.
Which is the eradication of doubt, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Let me pick up. Are you going to keep going?
No doubt. That's a nice section. Why don't you continue?
All right. He opened saying, Yovked Vovke said to me, do not attack Moab and do not provoke them to war. We've talked about this section. As it's written, you will approach opposite the Ammonites, do not attack them and do not provoke them. The Zohar makes a big deal about the lack of the phrase lamilchama, right, to war, how it's absent there, and the ammunition toward the Ammonites. Didn't we know until now that the Holy Blessed One was speaking with Moses and with no one else, right? So the obligation here is to Moses, not to anyone else. Why is it written that Yovked Vovke said to me? Well, the Blessed Holy One commanded only Moses not to harm Moab, not anyone else. To David, he didn't issue this command, so to me. So he told Moses, don't harm Moab, but David can do it, right?
Right.
And David, David has the obligation to do it.
As in, it was already clear from the context of the Bible that Moses was the one being addressed. So why do we add again that God spoke to me, to Moses?
Making it clear.
That the obligation or the restriction is only to Moses, right. which we're going to qualify in a second.
Right. So do not attack Moab, even invading the slightest bit across their border, for someone will issue forth from them who will wreak vengeance upon them on behalf of Israel, namely David, who was descended from Ruth the Moabitess. The Zohar revels in the irony, right? That don't destroy them because they'll produce their own destruction.
Which is, again,
I think that for the more Hasidic psychologization of these texts, you're your own worst enemy, right? God doesn't need to destroy you. Mm. You know, you'll produce the thing that will destroy you. And I think that's a lesson all of us. We're all our worst enemy.
There's also the sense that the eradication of the evil can only be fully done if it's imploded from within, which is why there's this really strict command. Don't even go the slightest across that border. Right. Like, don't touch that. It's going to implode upon itself. Let it just run its time.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great. Yeah. And again, there's something about sort of like, we always hear the refrain, don't immanentize the eschaton, right? That trying to force the hand of God to create utopia creates a nightmare, and so one has a sense that. That you don't force the hand of God in this sense.
Yeah. Like what's the great refrain from the Song of Songs, do not arouse nor awaken the love until the time is right. Alta iru, alta iru et ava
achtechbats. Right. And do not provoke them to war. Right? All this was commanded to Moses, but to no one else was it permitted. If you say, well, it was permitted to Joshua and those elders who outlived him, right? Because it's not Moses. Not so, for they were members of Moses' court, and what was forbidden to Moses was forbidden to them. It's a stretch of logic, I think, but we'll go with it. Furthermore, those fine pearls had not issued yet, for after all, in the days of the judges, Ruth issued, and she was a daughter of Eglon, the king of Moab. Eglon died, killed by Ehud. Another king was appointed, and this daughter was of his was orphaned, and she was placed in the home of a guardian in the fields of Moab. When Elimelech went there, he married her to his son. So there's some midrash stuff going on. They're finishing in some of the stuff that doesn't actually occur in the book of, but in the book of in the book of Ruth. But I guess, I mean, obviously the first argument I think is weaker than the second, that the pearls hadn't issued yet. I think it's also keen, right, that Ruth is like Shekhinah in some level, like she's born of a king and also goes into exile. Like she goes out of her own homeland. And so in that way you get, I think you kind of get kind of Shekhinah vibes from Ruth, the way this is, the way this is articulated, that she kind of goes into an exile because because of her family's killed. That's the other thing I wanted to say about that section. Also, there's just like the whole messianic thing, right? That there's kind of even David has a kingly vibe, right? Going back before he was born, but the kingly vibe, at least for the Zohar, is evil, right? That he's born from not just an evil nation, but from the king of an evil nation.
Right, right.
Right, that he really comes from like the worst.
Right, right.
And I think that is... again, you see this again with like a Messiah is born on Tish B'Av, right? That's the saddest, worst day Messiah will emerge.
Yeah.
Some Messiah emerges from the worst possible, from the Sitra Achra, the deepest part of Sitra Achra, and from this malevolent king. So I think that, there's the messianic irony is a little thick here and I think quite beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's also not something which you know from the text or I think is common knowledge at all. I think it's a rather... obscure rabbinic position that Ruth is the daughter of Eglon, but as you're saying, Justin, that it's being done very intentionally to tie the head of holiness to the head of evil, to make this one-to-one comparison, which is very important. This symmetry is very, very important for the Kabbalists, and we're seeing that throughout. It's funny because you mentioned by Moses and Joshua that it seemed like a stretch of the logic. It is because in the beginning we say that to me is to exclude anyone else, right? And then it's only excluding the very one person who we needed to be excluding, which is David, right? Anyone else can be included in that category of Moses. But on the other hand, there's something quite beautiful and romantic about that. This such a tight relationship between Moses and Joshua, right? He's described as the moon to the sun. As the moon was to the sun, so was Joseph to Moses, Joshua to Moses. Le yamush mi pia el, he never departs from the mouth of the tent. And the sense that when Moses is commanded something, it extends to Joshua. And for the Kabbalists, that's going to be very true because Moses is for them a historical figure to some degree, but more importantly, he's an archetype and he's an idea, he's a soul, he's a sphera. And that soul, the soul of the Redeemer, is going to be reincarnated in Moses and future generations up until today, as far as Kabbalists understand the metaphysics of reality. So yes, maybe a bit of a stretch for the modern reader, but I think in their context, it works out quite fine, actually.
Right. And again, we're thinking of courts, right? Like, this is a medieval thinking about a kingly court. And of course, they're all connected.
Right.
And again, it's ironic, right? That Joshua is a military general. That's what his job is, basically, to kill people. And so he's forbidden from this one.
Right.
He kills a lot of other people.
Right. Right.
But not this one group of people.
It's the house of Moses.
The house of Moses. Yep. Yeah, this is also a midrash that I'd never really come across, the whole business of Eglon. It's like one of these midrashim that I had not come across, before.
The phrase here in the English is also interesting, and I'd like to look at the Aramaic, that Eglon died, killed by Ehud. Died and killed is two different things. If we're going to be careful with our language,
right?
And I wonder, and knowing Matt as a careful translator, I'm assuming that there's something going on in the Aramaic there as well, and I feel like there's what to be quite frank, this whole section, and particularly this next clause, I didn't fully understand what it was contributing to the flow of the narrative, and I assume it's going to take a few more readings until that makes itself apparent to me. But I feel like there's a lot of the things which are appearing like these mysteries, the question marks at least are beginning to be apparent. What lies behind them, I'm yet to know.
Yeah, and you would think that, you know, the Zohar would be a little bit more on the face with the messianic stuff, with the symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're reading between the lines a lot to dig it out, but
yeah. I mean,
maybe it's just a case that it would be on the face to a real Kabbalist. It'd be a course, like we're talking about David, it's Messiah, like done. But one feels like this could be a moment where they're like, you know, Raza de Raza, like, you know, they could really milk it, and they the text chooses not to in a way that seems obvious. And maybe that's why, because it seems obvious.
I mean, it's interesting that so there's some famous research done on the Inukka by Ben Aruch, I think his name is pronounced, who looks at the messianic themes amongst others. And we've seen a lot of the messianic themes, right? The smelling and judging. But they've all been I'm trying to scan back quickly. I can't think of that many that have been made explicitly that they're messianic. But they're, I mean, they're very much just there, just not. Did we have explicit messianic? Was that ever made spelled out for the reader?
No, I mean, I think in some sections of Zohar it is. I mean, like in Midrash Nehanei Elam, the oldest.
No, I mean here specifically.
No. They never talk about Messiah. I think it's just meant to be read between the lines. And maybe that's a self-censorship thing too, right? This is text is being composed in sort of a Christian world, and you know, Messiah stuff in general, you know, I feel like they're not too on the nose about maybe for political reasons, but also maybe because it's just like easy. Like you're talking about David, you know, David coming out of this, and clearly it's not David that's important here, right? Not
in Yeah, I mean, David. By this point in Jewish history, it's David is the King Messiah, David Malka the Mashiach. That doesn't even need to be said.
Right. So maybe it's just we're mining it out because we're the ones who can't see,
seeing and not seeing.
Yep. So if you say that Elimelech was converted her there, no, rather she learned all the household customs and the food and the drink before she was converted. Only afterward, when she went with Naomi, did Ruth say, "Your people is my people, and your God is my God." So if you say Elimelech converted her there, no. I mean, this makes sense, right? Like, you can't convert someone on the spot. In fact, no one can convert anyone else, right? It's not like Elimelech is a Beit Din, and it's not like he can convert anyone. Right. It's not how conversion works.
Right.
But you do get the idea, right, that she's having to, you know, do what all converts do, is learn how to be a Jew first and then take the dunk. But she becomes a prototypical convert in this way. I guess, and also in the Ruth text, it's kind of making out why, you know, the gaps in the relationship of when Ruth shows up to Elimelech.
Yeah, I'm struggling to see what this is relevant to the bigger picture here. I mean, yes, we do. This is said in the context of a meal, and so food and drink, that's appropriate. But to the Amen Moav story, I got to be honest. I don't know what this clause is doing here.
And, I mean, maybe there's two things happening, right? Maybe one thing is happening here is that out of Moav will come obviously David, which is Messiah stuff, but also out of Ruth will come the ability of conversion, right? We think of the Israelites prior to that, with the exception of the mixed multitude, which have a very negative connotation for the rabbis.
Sure.
We don't have a real sense of conversion, of people, of redemption going outside, or anyone being able to come into the redemption. And so it may be one of the things that's happening here is not only is Ruth responsible for the redemption via David, but also she's responsible for the ability of the redemption to spread. And so in that way, her ability, her conversion, right? And again, and all the with all the parochial stuff that comes along with that, but her ability to convert him, right, is the idea that, you know, the redemption arc is broader now.
Right, right. And you're saying that's further emphasized by the fact that she learns all the household customs, food and drink, right, within the context of the filth of Moab, as the Zohar has described it, that it didn't even need it wasn't that that's okay, that thank you, that helps actually. It wasn't so we weren't allowed to, Joshua, let's say, and Moses, we're not allowed to attack the nation, and the redemption as well didn't need to be happening, it didn't need to be triggered or precipitated from the outside. It was from within the evil itself that she learned the ways of purity and sanctity. And that's doubling down on this motif of the redemption or the destruction / redemption of the evil happening from within and of itself. Okay, thank you, Justin.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I'm getting from this. And also, again, it just shows, right? Like, I think the lesson here is that nothing is beyond redemption. Maybe that you know, that we should be very careful about what we destroy and what we don't.
Right.
What we deem beyond redemption, because
right.
Who knows where Ruth? Who knows where Ruth is?
Also, I get the sense, in terms of lessons that we could take from this, that there are some things in life that are not for us to be interfered with. There are things, there are even evils in our life, which are better left to their own devices and left to time itself for them to sort themselves out. And I think that's knowing which pies to stick our finger into may also be a point of wisdom that could be derived from this.
Yeah, I think so. And again, also, like, the sex stuff is still here too with Ruth, right? There's like,
right,
lurking in the background. There's the threshing floor, right? So right. I think that there's also, like, you know, again, like, you get this, you know, the rabbis think of Ruth as being somewhat seductive, and so you get this, you know, Cosby versus Ruth.
That's definitely a reading that could be made here. Sure.
So again, just more kind of stuff that might be lurking between the lines. You may keep going, or you want to pick up with them, huh?
I could continue. I do get the sense that we're sitting we're sitting like in a kiddie pool with our toes in the water, and all the behemoths and the beasts and the sharks are all lurking beneath us, but we got to start somewhere. No. Naamah issued from amongst the Ammonites in the days of David. Then the Holy Spirit settled upon David and said to him, David, when I measured out the whole world, Israel was Chevel Nachalasei, the line of his possession. Deuteronomy 23:9. I remembered what Moab did to the line of his possession. So what is written of them, he measured them out, the Chevel, with the line. Chevel here meaning line or rope. A little play on the words here, because Chevel is... Chevel Nachalato is the line, the rope by which you measure the inheritance of the land that you receive, but also refers to the chain of the portion of one's inheritance that binds the Jew and God. So he measured them out b'chavel with a line, with a rope, with that line of God's possession. 2 Samuel 8:2. The line seized all those that were from that seed. So again, I mean, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse here at this point. We're going to be drawing this parallel back and forth between Israel and the enemy of Israel. So Israel, who is called Chevel Nachalato, the portion, the rope of God's inheritance, are going to be the enemy who attacked Israel is going to be counter-striked with the Chevel, with the line, and we will see now what that means. It is written, we're going to both see and expand this chevel imagery a little broader. With one full length of the rope. And Matt here is translating chevel as line, but I'm not sure why. It might be a bit more helpful to translate it as rope. What is meant by Meloi HaChevel? I have to say, by the way, I at least I can speak for myself. I've been somewhat critical of Matt's translation here and there, and I want to pause and just say how grateful I am for the enormous generational feat that he's done to translate this text. And any bicart, any criticism, any word here or there is only in the spirit of the war between the Inoka and his companions, between that we're honored to be here with Daniel Matt as a companion in this wonderful, wonderful gift that he's given us. I realized that last time after we spoke that it may seem that we're being overly critical or ungrateful. God forbid. Fabian.
God forbid.
We're very, very grateful. Thank you, Daniel. What is meant by Melea Hevel? By the length of this of the line, the fullness of the line of the rope, the one of whom it is written, the whole world, Meloi, is full of his glory, Isaiah 6:3. He said, this one is to be spared, and this one is to be killed, and that line sees those who are deserving of death. Therefore, he held that line, that rope, and stretched out the rope for that rope of God's inheritance, God's possession. So Matt's helpful commentary here fills us in to what's happening, that... And this is a very, we have like a double or triple wordplay going on here, which is quite nice. So Hevel Nachalasai, the rope of God's possession, referring to the people of Israel, the Chavel, the rope with which David measures in 2 Samuel, measures the enemies, the captured enemies from the Ammonites, and then he murders two-thirds of that length, if I got that correct. And so that's the first level of wordplay. The second level is that when we speak about Hevel, there's a verse in Isaiah. Sorry, there's a verse in the same chapter, rather, in 2 Samuel. We speak about Meloi HaHevel, the full length of one line, and the Kabbalist is using this word as a jumping pad to another time the word Meloi is used, which is a classic rabbinic hermeneutical trick, which is the Gzera Shava, connecting a word here and a word there, even though the contexts are not the same. And Meloi, of course, is Meloi Chalaretz Kaveri, the one whom fills all the world with his glory, which is God, but specifically the Shechina, who is the active filling participant. She is the Meloi, she is the fullness of God, which is also a beautiful idea. We think about the Shechina as the woman, and we mentioned before that she's full, she's fecund, she's pregnant, in some sense. We are the pregnancy of the Shechina, in some appropriate imagery. And therefore David, who's the Messiah, right, which is associated with the Sphira of Malchut, which is associated with Shechina, it goes from being in this double wordplay. What we do is we go from David being the one who is seizing the life of the seed of Ammon, to the Shechina herself acting through David to take these souls, to reap them back to where they're needing to go. So there's this word play which is doing this metaphysical play, which is giving us Shechina as this warrior character who's destroying the enemy of Israel, which is not a Shechina that we've seen up until the point in the text here, but certainly one of the Shechina is a very, very diverse and rich character, and that's certainly within her purview.
No, that's an excellent read, and it is a really elaborate, beautiful wordplay, it's really beautiful. And also it's interesting that it's not David getting to choose who lives and who dies. Right, that at some level that power, at least in this case, is not in his hands. Of course, he murdered lots of other people, but there's a sense in which, like, that because this is at some level part of a larger divine plan, it's only Shechina that can actually do the reaping.
Right.
Like it's the line, right? It's the line doing the, in the line, and that line sees those. And so it's interesting that again here that who's allowed to kill and who's allowed not to kill, right? We had this moment where David is allowed to attack and obviously take the prisoners, but the actual final blow at some level, at least of this blow, is not able to be committed by him. So it's against who is allowed to kill and who isn't.
That's an important point, that it's really only the hand of God who can do that. And even David, you know, the son of that, is not the one who does it. There is also something which is a bit uncomfortable here, which is about how arbitrary there's two readings here. One is that it's this predestined thing, and it's the and where the line falls is the will of Shechina or the will of God. But there's also the sense where it's very arbitrary. It's like this one dies, this one lives. It's a bit scary, a bit capricious, we could say.
Yeah. And I think that this is well before the days of liberalism. You know, this is not individual rights. This is communal guilt and sin, an idea that we find, I think, anathema now. But you know, even the Middle Ages, it was still thought guilt and innocence at some level could be a communal thing. And for the Ammonites, it is.
It's not just collective punishment here; it's collective cleansing here. These are very scary words, and they could certainly be used in very, very nefarious ways. And we must be vigilant that those readings do not be taken in that direction.
Yeah, and I think one of the bumpers for that kind of reading is that the Shekhinah is the one doing the reaping. Again, we can read other things about this, but it's about boundaries, right? It's like the Zohar is very clear that it's not David having to, David is not the line. He may draw the line, but the ultimate act is in the hands of God.
Right.
Which I think when you're thinking about hurting people, that's a good place. A good rule is like, this might be the task of God to do this, not me.
I heard a very interesting story, which ties in to this idea. There was, during the early debacle that broke out in the antagonism to the Hasidic movement, the antagonists, literally the Mitnagdim, the opposition, there was an attempt to put the leaders of the Hasidic movement in chayrim, in excommunication, and there was an attempt to gather signatures for this excommunication. And excommunication in those days was very serious. If someone was excommunicated, it could mean that they would lose their livelihood and they wouldn't be able to support and feed their wife and children. It was a death sentence, very, very possibly in such a traditional and tight-knit community. And the story goes that Chaim of Valozhin, the student, the grand student of the grand leader of the opposition of the Gaon of Vilna, was asked to sign the chirim against the Hasidic leaders, particularly the Alter Rebbe and some others. And he refused to sign the chirim according to this, and when asked, and then he said, but your master, your teacher, Eliyahu of Vilna the Gaon, he himself is signing the chirim, and you refer to him as the angel of God. Chaim of Valozhin had written a famous approbation, and he refers to him as Malech Alikim, the angel of God, language that we've seen here in the Enoka. Mm-hmm. And he says, how could you go against the angel of God himself is signing this decree? How could you differ from your master? And he said a very, very beautiful thing. He said that we see in the biblical story of the sacrifice of Isaac that an angel of God is enough for Abraham to put down his knife, but it is God himself who is needed for Abraham to pick up the knife. And that's a very beautiful idea.
Yeah, I think that's a good lesson, and a good lesson that even so why I don't trust angels.
They just don't have that authority.
And
we're gonna see that soon in the Enoka, right?
That's right.
Don't have much on us.
That's right. Yeah, they don't have much on us. I don't see why angels are such a big deal. All right. So as for Midian, coming back to Midian, now we're talking, switching from Ammon back to Midian, Gideon destroyed all that seed, not leaving any of those who would have harmed Israel by counsel or in any other way. Against all those who harm Israel, the Blessed Holy One retains enmity, wreaking vengeance upon them. But if good is destined to come from them, he delays his anger and wrath until a good emerges into the world, and afterwards he takes vengeance and executes judgment upon them. Rabbi Elazar said, certainly so, this is the elucidation of the matter. And then the Yanuka said, from here on, companions, Chavraya, prepare weapons of battle in your hands and wage war. He says, he's going to turn it up. There's not a lot here about Gideon, although Gideon's not a terribly good character in a lot of ways. I don't, you know, he's not, He's not that great of a character, but at least in this case, right, he does destroy the Midianites. But again, the text reminds us that he must wait until the goodness comes from them. But yeah, I think it's just, I'm not getting much out of that aside from it sort of reiterating the same point and bringing us to a conclusion around the Midianites.
Yeah, I mean, it's peculiar in how little it's adding. Mm-hmm. And that makes me think that there actually is something that it's adding that I'm not seeing.
Yeah, I'm not seeing. It's kind of, I mean, it's like, it seems, like I said, just sort of packaging up the whole story, right? We have the Ammonites, the Moabites, and the Midianites, and they all need to get their fate. And this is the fate of the Midianites.
What's annoying here, though, is Eliezer's response, rather. He says, certainly so, this is the elucidation of the matter. On the one thing which did not seem very elucidatory at all, like it just seemed like a recap, certainly so, this is the elucidation of the matter. Unless he's talking about, like, he's just saying that, yes, this is what we've been saying all along. I mean,
I guess he wraps it up. I mean, right. The last section did leave us hanging a little bit before they kind of zigged off to something else. So I guess this does button up the whole long digression about the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Midianites. So maybe this is just finally buttoning this section up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm somewhat unsatisfied.
Yeah. I mean, I have to admit this whole section was, I don't know. I mean, there's, both the xenophobia of it is like not palatable, but also it just doesn't, you know, hey man, like you're the Zohar, drop us some deep cuts, and this is just like, you know, and I guess maybe the more messianic reading that we're doing is, I guess, interesting, but again, that's sort of like not in the text. We're kind of reading it into it, so maybe that kind of elevates it, but maybe it's also. We're kind of getting this wavelength, right? We had this really high length in the last section we were dealing with, where you sort of the Hieros Gamos, and then we're bound back into the Sitra Achra, right? And then we're about to go back up to the world of the angels. So maybe there's a kind of a modulation. There's a kind of modulatory thing happening in terms of the literary format. So maybe that's interesting. But
it's interesting. I feel like it's kind of making us work for it a little more. And maybe it's on us to try harder.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think that, you know, I take the lesson that it's for God to take people's lives, and be careful how you treat your enemies, because redemption may come from them.
Yeah. The sense that what seems evil to us may be maybe the breeding ground of something very pure. Also, the image of the pearl, we noticed that the metaphor switched throughout. We went from organic metaphors of figs and wheat, and now a pearl. A pearl is an interesting one because it's that which forms in the belly of this, you know, fairly uninteresting or even maybe unpalatable creature, this bottom dweller, which. In rabbinic rabbinic spaces, you know, doesn't have much going for it, and yet the pearl is like this. It's like the diamond of the ocean. It's like so pure and white, and for the Kabbalist, whiteness is metaphysical, right? Lavan is not just. I mean, purity is very real for them in that sense.
And also, it's formed by irritation, right? And also. Whatever clam oysters are treif.
Right.
There's something about the uncleanliness of the animal, and the fact that it's forged, you know, by irritation, right? I think pearls are formed by like a grain of sand, and around that they get formed. And I don't know if the rabbis knew that or didn't know that, but I think that there's something interesting about that. Ruth is forged in Sitra Achra, and we always get the sense that. Sitra Achra is like the dross thrown off in the process of forging metal.
Right.
And in this sense, it's the opposite. Ruth is the pearl thrown off by the dross.
Yes.
So there's lots of, I think we could really push the pearl metaphor in lots of interesting, in a lot of interesting ways.
Yeah.
That she's the opposite of Sitra Achra.
Yeah. And I think it's helpful. I think it's helpful to turn, a Hasidic eye on this, which is that, which is the interiorized reading, which is, there may be elements in our own inner life and inner world, which feel to us to be irredeemable. They feel to be our own inner Ammon, Midyan, Moab, and we don't need to spell those out. We all know what those things are for us, and the things that and some of those things seem utterly irredeemable, and they seem like they alienate us from our best selves, from God, however we want to phrase that. And there's a sense here where it's like, no, it's okay. There's something at play which is bigger than you, and you don't need to fight it. You don't need to disturb it. It's doing its thing, and you'll see what comes of it. And there's something quite reassuring and wise in that.
I think you're right. Yeah. And there's this, seeing and not seeing, right? That that we may know what those things are and we may not. So I think that's be patient with your worst self. Because, redemption may be the case that not only may it come from your worst self, but it may only be able to come from your
worst
self.
Right.
But there's I think I love the idea in Zohar that that the best comes from the worst by necessity.
Yes.
By a kind of logical necessity of redemption. And so, I think that more Hasidic inward reading is the thing irritating you inside may be producing a pearl.
Mm. Well, there you go. We wrestled a pearl out of an irritating text.
With God's help. I think we said this before we went on live, that we both found this part to be kind of the text is that the text is the thing we have to wage war with, and right. when we find it to be right. We need to work harder.
Yes. We don't just come for the fireworks. We come for the cleanup, and we come for the preparation, and we come for the downtime. It's all part of the life of the text. I thought that we might get until this next natural break. This may be a good place to hold. I'm not sure. What do you think, Justin? I don't know when the next break is.
I think the next one is going to be
for a while.
Yeah, it's going to be all the angel stuff.
This might be. I mean, I know we're a bit earlier than time.
Yeah.
Maybe we could take a question or two or something. But this might be a good place to hold.
Yeah, I think maybe. Yeah, maybe we can open up for some questions if folks have questions. We're kind of an hour and a half, an hour 20 in. We'll usually go for an hour and a half, but I think this is a natural breaking point. Folks, I just wanted to express my extreme gratitude of all, 157 folks in the chat. This is the sixth session of us going through the Zohar. I just want to really express my deep gratitude for the folks who are coming along for any part of this journey with us. This is a hard text, and you're watching two guys who are grappling with it. I think one time, Zevi, you called yourself a tourist in the Zohar. I love that phrase. I'm very much a tourist as well. You can always tell the people who've never been to New York City because they're looking up. we're the people looking up in the Zohar, and we look like fools, I think some of the time, maybe most of the time, but I'm just really glad and really grateful that folks have come along for the journey. So thank you all.
Today.
So we have a couple questions. Let's just grab a couple, and maybe we'll go to like 10, like a hour and a half, hour and a little over an hour and a half. Is that good for you?
Yeah.
So layman's question. There's no layman questions here, folks. If you're here, you're not in layman's camp. I want to start learning Kabbalah. I'm fluent in Hebrew. Good for you. Would you recommend directly reading the Zohar to do so? Is there another text you would recommend for beginners? Could you believe that just today, apparently, Zevi, you want to break the news about for folks who can read some Hebrew?
I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Melila.
Oh yes. Yeah. Sorry, I blanked out. A good friend of ours, and a really world class scholar of Zohar, and world class human and mystic in her own right. Professor Dr. Melila Helner Eshed just put out a wonderful, wonderful book length introduction to the Zohar called On the Path of the Tree of Life. Al Derech Etz Chaim, I think was the Hebrew. She did that in collaboration with a wonderful younger scholar, also a friend, acquaintance of mine, Omri Sasha. And the two of them, it's literally just come off the press last Friday. So if you're a Hebrew reader, I highly, highly recommend reading Hoek. It's one which is deeply infused with both the finest, the scholarship, following primarily in the footsteps of her teacher, Yehuda Libus, but also with a deep, deep love for the Shechina, for the Zohar, for the Chabura, for the Rashbi. And you'll find both of those very beautifully woven together, as only Melillah does. And for those that don't read Hebrew, we're going to have to wait for the English translation.
Yeah. And if you can, if you only read English, her book on the Partzufim,
the Idra, right.
The Idra is an amazing correct. Book. It is the most difficult section of the Zohar, maybe the most difficult thing written in all Kabbalah. And she just makes it just like it's a walk in the park. It's just beautiful. It's a powerful scholarship, but also powerful insight from someone that takes the text very seriously, both as a text, as literature, but also as a spiritual text.
Mm.
So if you read English, also I'll say this maybe for Zohar, if you read Hebrew fluently and you want to start studying Zohar, what I would recommend you do actually is, folks may know this, the Zohar isn't one homologous text. It's made up of lots of little subsections, like the Yanuka. One of the earliest sections of the Zohar is a text called the Midrash HaNa'ilam, the Hidden Midrash. That section is written mostly in Hebrew. Mostly in Hebrew. There's a little Aramaic in there. And if you want to kind of get Zohar training wheels, reading Zohar, and kind of getting used to the way how Zohar works, that's the section I would start with first. Because once you kind of get to how the Zohar thinks and how it writes in Hebrew, then you could jump to other texts like the Yanuka, which is very narrative, right? It's not like the Sefer Tzniuta or some crazy right. text like that.
Right.
This is much more narrative. And once you kind of get that, then you can begin picking up the weird idiom of the Zohar. Also studying the Yerushalmi. That's the closest Aramaic to this text, in my opinion.
Mm. Yeah, I would also say for the Hebrew speakers and readers out there, I mean, there's a classic Hebrew, like interpolated commentary in the Zohar, the Matok Midvash, sweeter than honey. And that's a classic for anyone that can follow along in the Hebrew. And he does a good job translating and explaining, not that much explanation, but just, you know, at least translating.
Yeah. And also, if you're a Hebrew reader, what I'd recommend getting is a version like this one. This is the one that I have. It has the Zohar Manukad, so you can read in the Aramaic with the vowels, but also has a in Lashon Kodesh has a Hebrew translation right there. So if you get lost in the Aramaic, typically you can jump over to the Hebrew and you're like, it will be a bit clearer. So that's another way, because I mean you have to really be on your Zohar chops to read just straight Aramaic. Like, you have to, that's, it's beyond me. I can't do that. I have to have a lot of, definitely have training wheels, both intellectually and linguistically.
Certainly.
It's an interesting question, I guess. We could, do all Jewish honor Kabbalah? I guess Jews, most do. There are very few Jewish sects out there that are anti-Kabbalah these days, huh?
I mean, certainly historically there have been those who didn't vibe with Kabbalah. There are some camps today that don't have love for Kabbalah, and I think sort of on both sides of the religious spectrum, both in more liberal circles and in more Orthodox circles. But it's more and more of a fringe position ever since like the 16th century onwards. You know, there's a famous Ari Nochem, which is this attack on Kabbalah, and there are some contemporary Rambamists, you know, these Maimonideans who have kept up that animosity towards Kabbalah. There's a misunderstanding that which assumes that the Misnagdic movement was anti-Kabbalah. They weren't. They were great Kabbalists. They were against the way that it was being disseminated. But there are camps. There are groups here and there who aren't fans of Kabbalah, but a, you know, a small minority.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, and also like there's, you know, it kind of, I will say that it is interesting to me, and it's a thing that I've noticed, like in the more liberal world, is just like Kabbalah kind of textual ignorance. Like it's only in the liberal Jewish world that the Zohar isn't canon in some level. Like that's always struck me as, and there's a reason for that. It has to do with the 19th century Wissenschaftliches Judentum movement. But it's just interesting that Zohar isn't just sort of one of the things that people would do a drasha on in like a recon shul. I was talking to my partner who's a rabbi. She went through from Hebrew college, and it was interesting. I was asking her, like, you know, in the 5 years you were there, was Kabbalah ever a thing that you had to take? Like, you had to take Gemara, but did you ever have to take Zohar? And she's like, no, most places, like, it's totally optional.
Yeah, I would say as well that in many circles, even in more Orthodox circles, Kabbalah and the Zohar is more revered than it is read. Mm-hmm. And it may be canonized and held up at a very at a very supreme place conceptually, but that doesn't mean necessarily that it's going to be engaged with, and certainly not directly. To find direct engagement with Kabbalah, you need to be going to certain specific Sephardi communities or certain Hasidic communities, not even all of them. The ideas will certainly be permeating, but direct, I mean, I studied to be, I don't like talking about this publicly, but I studied to be an Orthodox rabbi, and we didn't have to learn any Kabbalah for that. We didn't have to learn any Zohar for that either. So Alana and I are in the same boat as far as that goes.
Do you know if on the Rabbi Newt test in Israel, is there any Kabbalah questions on there at all?
No, not at all. No.
Yeah. It's all
Shulchan Aruch. It's all Beis Yosef, like Ramah, Nesekalim. It's all halacha. It's all Jewish law.
I mean, I'm not surprised, and that's interesting. Also, point out that a congregant and leader of our community here at Congregation Techiah, Jake, is in the chat. I think Art is no longer at Hebrew College. I mean, Chassidut, I think, had some place at Hebrew College because of Art. And that's, you know, that has Kabbalah baked in, but
right,
like not really.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it will filter through, but you're not going to find a shir. You're not going to find a class where Zohar is actually being gone through and read, as we're doing here, for example.
So, would you recommend to start with Yehuda Ashlag and Michael Leitman commentary on the Zohar to start with? I think I'll say. Like I think Yehuda Ashlag is really interesting. Don't read him in English because there are lots of translations of the Baal Sulam, the Yehuda Ashlag, but they're just like Hebrewish. Every word is just like technical Hebrew word from Kabbalah. And so it's just like, you might as well just learn to read Hebrew if you're going to read it. Also, this is, I'll just lay it out there. I don't like Lurianic Kabbalah. I don't think it's, I'm not a Kabbalist, but I just don't like Lurianic. I just don't like it. I'm much more on the fan of Cordovero. And I find that Lurianic Kabbalists, like they work so hard to shove the Zohar into a Lurianic framework that when you read Lurianists on Zohar, I think you're not reading the Zohar. I think you're getting a very distorted vision of what's going on in the text. And I'm not trying to say like I'm a Zohar only person, but I think that it's better to have gotten a grasp of what's going on in the text first before you read someone who's going to shove it into like an Ashlagian. And again, Cordovero does the same thing. I'm not saying he doesn't, but I think he's staying much closer to the spirit of the Zohar than Luria does. I'm going to get Zohar canceled. I'm going to get Kabbalah canceled now. But you can't be, but whatever, like
Funny, Justin. Oh my god.
But I just don't like it. I don't like even Sarugian uptake, which is much less Baroque than Chaim Vital's uptake of the Arizal. I just don't like it.
No, that was funny because I thought you were gonna go after Leitman or Ashlag, but you just went right after the Ari.
Yeah. I gotta be careful when I say stuff like this.
That was so funny. That called me so unexpectedly. I mean, I know I've heard you say this before, but in the context of a question of Lightman and Arsenal, it's hilarious.
Have you read much of the Baal Salem? I haven't read Michael Lightman's commentary, but I've spent time with the Yehud Ashlag.
I'm gonna say no comment here. It's not within my tradition, let's say.
Okay. Yeah, that's a great dodge. Yehud Ashlag is interesting. I mean, just to like his politics, like the weird communism that he invented.
Right.
Like the spiritual communism that he invented, that sort of like Kabbalistic communism is like Kabbalism. It's fascinating.
I have to figure out what to answer to this question, because I get it every once in a while, you know, from people through the channel of like modern Kabbalah teachers, and I wouldn't put Lightman and Ashlag in the same. Anyhow, I'm not going to say anything for now until I figure out what to say.
Yeah, that's why I just went straight to the Arizal. Like,
yeah.
I can just complain about him.
Savage.
Whatever. I do wish that
no one's going to sue you for complaining about Luria, basically.
Someone in Svat's going to get my posted in Nora on me. I'm gonna really die on this Cordoveran hill. I'm gonna become like the Cordoveran standard bearer.
Have you made? Did you make some content on Cordovera?
Just on his I want to make one on the Tome of Devorah, but just on his guide to studying
right
his guide to studying Kabbalah, which is fascinating, because there's that great line where he talks about studying Zohar on Esther, which doesn't exist or doesn't exist anymore.
Right Someone in this circle needs to make a full-on like exposition of his thought. That's if we're gonna be fans of him, we may as well.
Yeah, I need to do something. It's hard though. Part of it is text. Yeah. And Or Yachar is not even fully translated, I don't think, yet. Like his commentary on the Zohar is 23 volumes long, some crazy, it's huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's even totally done yet.
There's been a bit of scholarship. I think we were chatting about this sometime before, myself and Philip, about what scholarship's been done and if we could do a video on him or something. But one of these days, God willing.
Yeah, I think he's
he deserves it.
He definitely does. And also the Tome of Devorah would be a great text to do because it's so accessible and it's like practical Kabbalah in the sense of like, here's how to make this sort of way you live. So it's very nice. It's a very approachable text in that way.
I would say though, anyone that's looking for Kabbalah as what they think of Kabbalah is not gonna be very. They're not gonna be excited. They're not gonna find it in the text, basically.
Right. Just be Orthodox. Be from. There you go.
It's much more of like a Musar text. It's much more of like an ethical.
Yeah, but yeah, someone's asking about the Orchard of Pomegranates. Yep, that's the text that we were talking about. I've worked through chunks of it in Hebrew because I don't think it's totally translated. In English, and I've worked through chunks in Hebrew, and it's tough.
It's also an encyclopedia. It's not a book, right?
Right. Yep. Yeah. It's not an easy text. Also, I've had people repeatedly ask me to do an episode on the Tanya. So, Zevi, I'm punting that to you.
It's so hard to do books that are close to home. It's so hard. It's not fair. I can't do them. You do Tanya, and I'll do. Judaism as a civilization.
There you go. Yeah, that would be a funny mashup. But the Tanya is also hard because it's not one book. It's like
it's a very difficult text. It's a text that I've struggled with my whole life. It will be a long time before I feel.
Well, yeah, it'd be funny to do a text on Judaism as a civilization. The least Seekers of Unity content ever. I do like that it was burned. Like they Orthodox rabbis brought it into the head of the Yiddish radio channel in New York and like
burned it on live radio.
Yeah, yeah, and they like alive. There was a live excommunication.
ASMR, a book bunny.
It's just something about, and also like when they did, I think they did it in like whatever the 40s. It was like just the most tone deaf thing to do. Yeah, like come on, guys. Like, are you not in the world?
My big. Having said that, my big regret of having only produced video content this time, this, you know, until now, is that no one can bone a video. It makes me very sad that, you know.
You still get excommunicated for it though.
Yeah, but I'm a tactile person. I'd like to be. God forbid. No one should bone books. God forbid.
Is it Rilke said?
Those that burn books.
Yeah, those that burn books will eventually burn people.
Yeah.
So I'm going to. Jojo asked about the Index Prohibitorum. I'm actually making an episode, probably not next week, but maybe the week after, on the Inquisition. I'm going to do an episode on the foundation of the Inquisition, and I'll talk about the Index.
Wow.
I'll talk about the Index. It's a cool book to get, by the way. You can get copies of the Index from the 18th century for like $50, and it'll like you can see like Spinoza and Descartes and all their names are in it.
That's cool. That's super cool.
It's a cool book to earn. It's a cool book to have. To look at all the banned books, then so now you basically have a reading list.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
So it's any book that was on the Index is probably worthy of reading. You know that Pico della Mirandola was the first person on the Index.
Yes, the first one to be. I was. You know, it's so funny you say that. In my mind, I knew that I had a name, and I'd actually mentioned it in a previous episode. And I'm like, who was it that I said? It was Pico. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
Pico was the first person. On the
Index. It was the oration. Yep. Right. Yeah. Yep. You pulled that thought right out of my head.
So that's a funny claim to fame that he could take. All right, folks. Well, I think we're going to wrap up. We're at 284. We have 10 pages left, I think. 12 pages left in the mat. Probably 2 dapim left in Aramaic, like the way we're going. But we're going to keep on keeping on next Thursday, I guess. So more Yanuka next time. But yeah, folks, thank you again for hanging out with us, and we'll do some more Zohar with all of y'all next time.
Good to be here.